You take control and make the choice yourself. What moments spark those endings? What idea or experience or epiphany leads to dramatic changes in your career and life? Today's Career Buzz guests help us understand the transformational experiences that lead to renewing your life by quitting one thing and starting something else. And sometimes that something else is nothing short of an entire movement, a movement to help others quit things that no longer are aligned with what matters, a movement to change the way corporations look at volunteer programs. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, leader of career management company Career Cycles, and we help people make career and life choices aligned with what really matters to them. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Dean Dwyer began, as he says, to quit shit and discovered that his life has taken an amazing turn for the better as a result. At the end of 2008, he quit his job because he realized he no longer liked anything about it. What happened? Life began to unfold as it should. Ideas started to come his way, and he began attracting more of what he wanted. What's he doing with himself? Dean says his goal is to create a movement to get people like you to quit shit. Author of the Quit Bit blog, we'll talk to Dean Dwyer a little later in Career Buzz show today. But first, Chris Jarvis's journey began on the streets of Toronto. He was working alongside scores of at-risk youth. There, he was confronted with the harsh realities, including prostitution, drugs, homelessness. And there, he experienced a life-altering moment of epiphany. That moment enabled him to begin to receive vital gifts held out to him by the hands of those often deemed needy. He entered into the cycle of brokenness and wholeness offered by this community and embarked on his own journey of transformation. Now, Chris's mission is to invite others to these moments of epiphany. In part, Chris does this through his company called Realized Worth, co-founded with his partner, Angela Parker. Their expertise is in designing and implementing employee volunteer programs. He's worked alongside organizations across North and South America, Europe, Africa, and Asia, utilizing a model that elevates volunteerism from a task-oriented activity to a transformative experience. Chris is currently collaborating on a comprehensive guide to corporate social responsibility for human resources managers. Chris Jarvis joins me live in studio today. Welcome to Career Buzz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Chris, what do you like about your career these days?
Well, I'm doing what I like, and I'm doing a lot of it, and I'm doing it the way I like to do it. And it's very meaningful work, which I think means that it comes out of who I am instead of it's just what I do.
And what are you doing as part of who you are these days?
Well, that's a good question. Everything we want to do or acting out of who we are, I think, needs to have a context. So it could be as a plumber, it could be as an engineer, it could be a number of different places. That may be up to what your tastes are. But when we do something out of who we are, I think it comes from the core of what we're about. So for me, it is reproducing this event that you mentioned that I had in downtown Toronto. It's creating space for people to have epiphany. Now, you can't create transformation in people. You can't change people. But you can create the right kind of space for people to experience transformation and for people to have epiphanies. In 12-step groups, they talk about being sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yes.
That's their epiphany. That's the moment where they've reached the bottom and they're ready to make a significant and substantial change. And that can happen for all of us. We don't need to be addicted, but we can get to a point in life where we think, you know what? I'm on the wrong track. I'm not going the right direction. This isn't coming out of who I am, or maybe I just don't like who I am. So I'm working now to help create that kind of space where people can realize or at least have those epiphanies.
And you're doing that in part by creating volunteer programs or consulting with corporations to help them create volunteer programs to create these moments of potential epiphanies. Is that how it's working?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So corporate volunteering is becoming more and more popular. More and more companies are getting into corporate social responsibility or corporate responsibility, trying to become better citizens and doing it in a way that is obvious to the community around them. One of the most meaningful things that they can do is actually bring to bear their employees' connections, resources, skills to the community and provide solutions that the community might be to problems the community might be facing. So in that is a great opportunity to create some space where people go beyond what they know and what they're comfortable with and get into some space where they can have an epiphany. Now, not everybody's going to. For some people, it's going to be a very transactional moment. They go, they give time, they leave, they feel good. But for other people who are ready, and we're all ready for different reasons, going back to our 12-step illustration, but when people are ready for something different, if they're in the right kind of space and they can have that moment of epiphany, that can be very transformative. And I've found all I'm doing is reproducing my experience.
Yes.
So I take people to where they can meet people who seemingly have nothing to offer and are broken and are just racked with pain and just a life of abuse. And they begin to realize these people still have significant things to offer. They have gifts. Their value isn't based on the labels or their clothes or their car they're driving, the money they make, how fast they run, how pretty they are. None of those things, how much they buy, sell, produce, none of those things have to do with their value. The value comes from something far more innate, something far more cosmic than that. And when people get into a place where they can really see that, they begin to reevaluate, what is it that I'm after? Where am I placing my value? Who am I? What am I about? And that can be a moment of epiphany for a lot of people.
So it sounds amazing and fascinating. So I'd like to find out more, and also for listeners to figure out how they might plug into these kinds of opportunities. But first, can we step back and figure out how you got here, what your journey was, and you know, moving up to that moment of epiphany that you had on the streets of Toronto. Stepping back in time, where does all this come from for you? What did you study? What did you do post-secondary to get us to the point where you had this moment?
So I work with companies now in the area of corporate social responsibility. And so that's an interesting field because nobody took a direct route to get there because it's only a recent development, right? And it's becoming more and more formalized. Schulich School of Business was just rated number one by the Aspen Institute for their corporate social responsibility position and training, education, what have you. But for those of us who might be in the field now, practicing it, we got there by, you know, some of us were HR people, some of us were communication people, some of us were in brand management. I happen to come from the side of things of a nonprofit background.
Yes.
With a theological training. So, ergo, there's a bit of spirituality, to what I talk about. I think it's completely legitimate. But it's probably a little bit unexpected for people. So yes, I used to work in churches with faith communities, get into the nonprofit side of things, but then didn't want to only be working with one specific part of the population.
Yes.
So decided to go to companies and work with them.
But before we go to the companies part, you know, listeners might also be interested in how you ended up choosing to go to a divinity school. You pursued a master's of divinity,
yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
What did you do? What was your first step into post-secondary, and then how did you end up choosing the master's of divinity as a next step?
That's a good question. I kind of grew up in that culture. I grew up in a church culture, faith community culture kind of thing. So some of these were sort of logical steps. It was what I knew. It was what I was interested in. And I was interested in working in a church as a pastor. So I had an undergrad in theology and decided to get my master's.
So your career plan, even coming out of high school, was something to do with theology, ministry. That's where you were going.
Absolutely.
So the undergrad was also in theology.
Yes.
The master's. Were you planning to be ordained?
Yes, and am.
And you are ordained.
Yeah, yeah. So that was my track. In fact, in one way or another, I've been pastoring for the past 20 years.
Yes.
Until recently, I've stepped out of that for the past 2 years, being here in Toronto, in an official role kind of thing.
We're talking to Chris Jarvis here of Realized Worth. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on Career Buzz, CIUT 89.5 FM. So, Chris, what happened? After you finished divinity school, you became ordained, you were working as a pastor, something triggered a change there. So take us through those moments where you were working in faith-based communities, you're working in churches, and something twigged. You decided you wanted to expand.
Right. So a fairly traditional, middle-of-the-road, middle-class white guy working in Milton, just here in Toronto.
Yes.
A community outside of, it was a much smaller. They hadn't built the water pipeline there, so there wasn't the big expansion that's there now. And the community was struggling to know what to do with large hordes of teens that were gathering around. And a group of teenagers that is larger than three or four can be scary.
Yes,
yes. To older folks. Not to all of them, but what do we do with these guys? Oh, they're going to cause trouble. I saw them drop, cigarettes on the ground, whatever. So they decided they wanted to drop in. Now, I didn't know anything about Drop-In, but I certainly had some time, so I volunteered for it. And I hooked up with some guys from Sanctuary, Yonge Street Mission, doing some work down here in Toronto. And they helped orient me and mentor me. But they said, you know what, Milton is a feeder community to the city of Toronto. We get 5 to 15,000 kids come through here. Some of them just come through as tourists in the summer, live on the streets for a while. Others make it their life goal to be, you know, nobody's life goal. That's a crass way to say it. But that's what they end up doing through a whole bunch of bad choices. Yes. They're on the streets. But these kids, a lot of them, and a lot of your listeners would probably know this, they come from really average, middle-of-the-road, very expected homes from all around Toronto, but for some reason or other, they're living in downtown Toronto. So they said, Milton's a feeder community. Let's show you what happens if you don't get them there first. And a drop-in's a great way to do that. Made sense to me. So we talked about issues about why homelessness occurs, why kids run away from home, what kids do when they're here, how they get involved in drugs, what drug dealers do to get them hooked, how kids get killed, how they end up in prostitution, how young boys who are straight end up turning tricks just to pay their bills. It was, I mean,
real eye-opener.
Yeah, it was. It was huge. And so they took me on the corner. We were down in the village, and AIDS was just coming onto the scene at the time in a big way, and in terms of knowing about it and the spread of it and not knowing what to do about it. And they said, can we ask you a question? I said, sure. They said, listen, we're working with Susie down the street. She's a working girl. She's got two kids, and she wants to get off the street. She's been on the street for many, many years. She owes some money. She doesn't have her GED. She wants to get her education. You work at a church in Milton, right? Yeah. And there's probably a lot of families with basements with nobody living there, right? Would one of them take her in? I said, I don't know. No, come on. You know those folks. Who could we call tomorrow? We'd like to get her there. They can help with her kids. They can get some boots for her kids. And it was the winter. And they can, you know, look after them, provide some child care, and she can get her education. They maybe even could loan her some money till she gets on her feet to pay her drug debt off. And who would help her? I said, guys, I'm sorry. I don't know anybody. They poked me in the chest and they said, then what the blank good is your God to anybody? Okay, my world just fell apart. I just graduated with a Master's of Divinity. I knew Hebrew, I knew Greek, and I couldn't answer the simplest question of how any of it mattered.
Yes.
In the most basic, most traumatic sense of it all, right? What if it wasn't good news for her, it wasn't really good news for anybody. It's just a club we all belong to. So I had a bit of a breakdown, and I quit. I quit that church, and we got the drop-in going. I quit after that. It was a big success. I moved to Halifax and started working with people on the streets. That was my primary community now.
So the moment that you realized the question was asked of you, what good is your God anyways, was a moment for you of realization.
Yeah.
Like, this guy's asking the most practical and important question, and I actually don't have an answer.
Didn't have a clue. I did not have an answer. It's rigorous study to get this degree, right? And somehow we had skipped. Poor is a word used more in the Bible than any other word.
Yes.
We skipped it. Totally. I thought that I can't be a part of something that irrelevant.
What happens when your balloon gets popped, so to speak, metaphorically? Like, there's a moment, you know, you had been blowing that balloon up with education and learning and your background and your family of origin, and that balloon got to a certain size and you thought you had a lot going, and then in a moment, the balloon gets popped. What did that feel like for you?
Well, it felt like driving around, listening to the radio. Any song, doesn't matter. Happy song, sunshine song, whatever. Starting crying for no reason. I mean, it was a serious breakdown. Because at the church, I was also being pushed in a certain direction that they were saying, you know, they just need activities. We don't have these issues you're talking about. That's in downtown Toronto. But I was seeing kids who were coming. They were weekend alcoholics. Some of them were talking about their uncles who were doing weird things. We had one girl living in, I swear to you, a van by the river. Like, it wasn't a river, it was a pond. But it's still, living there with her boyfriend because there's no other option for them. And these churches all around, we were pouring tons of resources and time, and we didn't have anything practical to offer other than activities or sporting events. And if you didn't fit into that, you just didn't fit in. So,
Did the woman from the street get a basement in Milton?
No, never.
That didn't happen?
Did not happen. No.
So what happened next with you, Chris? When you had that realization, you said you moved to Halifax. What happened?
Well, and it's interesting you use the word realization, because at that point the word realize worth began to take form in my mind. I think we came up with a phrase maybe 2 years ago, but the seed for it had been planted, because there is a value in people that exceeds the externals. Okay, so I began to go, I went to Halifax, I began to hang out with a couple of women who mentored me and said, here's what life is on the street, here's their names, here's who they are. And I integrated in that community, started going to 12-step groups, was working in a little church that had been very traditional, but we filled it up with a bunch of people. After the service, people would come through and shake my hand and say, great, that's great. I'm going to group tonight, you coming? I'll say, okay, AA, or is it NA, Narcotics Anonymous? And then then someone else would say, hey, I got to go back to prison for 8 months, if you can write me letters. I mean, we had a really wrecked congregation. I mean, it was ruined, and it was great. Those are the best days, just with that little crazy group of people. And even now, it continues in Halifax. I was just there a few months ago, and that community, the normal people, quote unquote, who could hold on and are still part of it, are still in the not so normal people. I don't like using these labels, but I think for our listeners, it's a quicker way to kind of explain what we're talking about.
So then, how did that shift you into thinking of changes in your career and life? You had this experience, you were plugging in with the community, you were starting to answer the question that you couldn't have answered before in Toronto. You started to immerse yourself in fact, in another world. What happened for you in terms of moving your own story forward at that point?
That's a great question. So ended up working with a few other churches and got to a point where I knew that if I stayed working with faith communities, and don't forget, the goal was to create space for people to experience transformation, right, to have their own epiphany. And they could have that epiphany by meeting Bob, who just got out of jail, right? I could offer those moments of transformation, whether it worked or not and whether people were ready for it or not. When I put, Bill, the middle class guy, with Bob, the guy who just got out of jail, Native Canadian, or he's part of the black community, or whatever, and put them across from each other. People usually don't sit across from each other, and the unexpected guy is actually offering to say a little prayer for this guy's family. I mean, I saw guys ruined, reduced to tears. I saw people would say, I came to help, but now I'm getting more help out of it. I feel guilty about volunteering, right? So the moving parts of creating space for this moment, these moments to happen, are the same whether we're working with faith communities or we're working with businesses. And so I realized that after coming back here, businesses are struggling to help their employees find meaningful moments that connect what they do in the everyday with who they are, right? And sometimes just filing won't do that. So if you can build in a piece where that company is investing in community in a meaningful way, and you can create space for this to happen, you can start to integrate those two things together, and you can start to, on a very crass level, you'll see a return on investment in that. Because that person becomes more enthused, more interested, more productive. There's a whole lot of benefits that are very practical, but the core that we're after in all of this are those moments of epiphany for people.
So in your story, you then created this, is it a company, Realized Worth?
Yeah.
And you created this with the express purpose of helping organizations, for-profit, not-for-profit, create those. There was a moment there somewhere between the Halifax experience and now being back here in Toronto and starting this thing up. How was that transition? Was that an easy flow because it just made sense? Or was there another threshold to pass through to make this happen?
It was also rather cataclysmic. There are a lot of parts to that story, but I think I got to a point. I was coming up to 40. This is so typical, isn't it? 40? That stupid number. We're living longer. It should be 50 now. But anyways, it's 40. And I was thinking, okay, if I don't make a change now, this is the only context that I'll be able to express who I am. And there's nothing wrong with that. I could still enjoy getting to do what I was doing. And I was working at the time with a large congregation in Indianapolis who were great. They were fantastic. But I knew that if I didn't make this change, if I didn't do something now, the success would keep me trapped.
Yes.
Right? Because you've got easy opportunities in this one lane ahead. It's just easy and it's open and it's inviting. And as long as you're good with that, that's great. But if you want more options, you need to you know, for us, we started over from scratch. We had no context, no connection, nada.
We now, your partner.
Oh, my partner, Angela
Parker.
And
so you decided to do that. So, you know, as listeners are thinking about this, hitting a certain age and deciding that you want to go for this thing that's kind of hard, but
yes,
it's more a full expression of who you are,
yeah,
rather than the easy track.
Yes.
And, you know, there's some kind of process that you go through to actually let go of the easy track and pick the one that may be harder but is way more meaningful.
Yes.
Was there a moment when you decided that? How did you get help to do that? Did you figure it out on your own? Did you and Angela talk about it? How did that happen?
Well, I started working with Angela after I got here. So came back here, didn't really know what I was going to do. I think I didn't have a clear plan of what it would look like. And honestly, we get back together 2 years from now, I'll have better words for it, and I'll have a much clearer idea of what it is, you know, the niche, the area that I'm in.
Yes.
Kind of thing. But I got to a place where I had to be okay with what I didn't know, and that had to seem better than what I did know, right? There wasn't enough pain, and I didn't see enough gain, but I had a hunch of something. And I knew I didn't want to be 70 years old and say to myself, I didn't even try. You know? For me, that was the thing. But I can't remember a moment where I was. You know, maybe some people can, and there are certain points in my life, like the story about being downtown Toronto.
Yes.
I can remember that moment. But there wasn't a moment. There was sort of a slow realization that came over me. And so by the time I verbalized the decision, somewhere inside of me it had been made.
Yes, I got it. You said something like, I was okay with what I didn't know, and that was more important than what I did know.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of a realization,
yeah,
that helped you pick this other track and not wanting to turn older, become older, and say, I didn't try.
Yeah.
Those are the two things that you said to yourself that made you shift gears into this.
Yes. And I probably said them like 1,000 different ways.
Yes.
In weird moments, like in the video store.
Yes.
Or driving, or when I'm in a conversation with someone and they don't even know I've had those thoughts. But yeah, they kind of pile up.
All right, so now you're here. You know, I saw on your site, and we'll get listeners to visit it, and we'll let them know. But it says something about that your approach avoids the complexity of most popular approaches in volunteer management theory while increasing participation and satisfaction rates. How does that work?
Great question. Most volunteering is fairly transactional. There's an event, you show up for it. And most people who volunteer, at least for the first time, are volunteering for what we call extrinsic reasons. It's what I should do, I should give back, I've had so much in my life, I've been blessed, I need to contribute, these issues, someone should be doing something, whatever. There's nothing wrong with any of those reasons. That
yes,
gets you through the door. What's important is to create the right kind of space to meet people at their highest level of contribution. And at the beginning, that's very low. So you make your expectations as a receiver of volunteers very low. And you offer people an experience. You let them get some dirt under the fingernails, but you don't ask them to marry you on the first date. It might not even be a date. Maybe you're just at a mixer. I don't know, but that's rude.
Yes.
And they're going to commit for very extrinsic reasons, unless you're cherry picking. And I find a lot of organizations, that's what they're after. They're after someone who's highly qualified, understands issues. If they have education in the background, that's great. They have great connections. Then they're willing to dump all of their life into it. Well, there are people like that out there, but somebody's invested a lot of time and energy to create that person. And nonprofits have to take the responsibility to create outstanding volunteers. And they do that by creating outstanding volunteer experiences. Low threshold at the beginning, no expectations. They have the experience. They come. And if they come back, and 1 out of 20 will, they're coming back because they're starting to personalize the motivations for being there. So they move from extrinsic, oh, I should do this, everybody else is, to that guy I was telling you about who
yes,
says, I feel guilty. And he feels guilty because he's there for very selfish reasons. That's great. You can count on self-interested people. You can count on selfish people. Think about it this way. If you're in a relationship with someone and they say they're in love with you and you say you're in love with them and they say, I love you for what you can become. Okay. All right. And I love you because my parents said I should love you. And I love you because we got married in church and that's what's expected of us. And I just want you to know I've made all these commitments and I'm going to follow through on them. You kind of went, well, what about me? Like, I want to be loved by someone who loves me because they don't want to live without me, because they need me. I want them to be completely selfish about it. I trust that. I completely trust that. All those external motivations, that'll get you through the door. That, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just not good enough for where you need to go with people. So you need to give people a place where they can personalize and internalize their motivations. And if you create the right kind of space, you meet them where they're at, and you coach them along, you give them more and more opportunities to explore, and you turn your staff into facilitators of these volunteers who can actually lead the charge, then you've got a powerhouse organization that's creating volunteers who are highly committed, highly devoted, and will go to the wall for you, not because it's the right thing to do or altruism, but because there's no other place in the world they'd rather be than by your side.
That sounds right on.
Yeah.
You know, and for listeners, like, let's think of listeners now and people out there. Some people can facilitate the creation of these programs in their companies, and other people are staff in these companies who would love to be part of a volunteer program if only their corporation would. Let's talk about the second group for a second.
Okay.
Let's say you're listening to the show now and you think, wow, that sounds really good. Chris is onto something. Why doesn't my company have anything going on? What can somebody do in their company? Who do they speak to? What if it's not like a huge corporation like Scotiabank that has, you know, a corporate social responsibility department? What if it's like an average corporation and maybe they don't have something like that, but they think we ought to? What should they do?
Well, if you're in the we ought to group, you probably corporate social responsibility is pretty widely adopted right now, and you're companies probably talking about it, whether they're doing it and what form they're doing it. There's kind of like five levels you can do it at. But anyways, so let's say they want to do something, and chances are you're in a company, if it's large enough, they're doing something, right? So we'll say it's a large company as opposed to a smaller company, because that's a little easier to infiltrate, okay? So you're in a large company, and you're working the line, right? Or you're the sales rep and you want to do something. You're volunteering yourself and you just want to see this brought to your friends and neighbors. You're like me. You've had this moment. You bought in. You just think, this is the best thing ever. Other people should get a chance to explore and understand this. Well, here are some things that you need to know. Unless you get the highest level of endorsement, like C-suite executives, CEO, CFO, COO, whatever, it's a tough sell. Okay? But you can do it by creating groundswell. You can do it by going out and volunteering. You can do it. Most companies, like I said, have something in place. Find out what that is. Your company probably has something in place. They probably have dollars for doers. Most companies, if you're donating your time or your money somewhere, they'll match it.
Okay? Right, or they'll give you at least paid time off to do your volunteer gig.
A lot of companies will do that too.
Yeah.
But only 2%, I think that's a stat, take advantage of dollars for doers. Why?
2% of staff take advantage, yeah.
Nobody knows about it.
Yeah.
So go ask your HR person, rep, whatever. Do we have that? Ask your manager. Then start to invite some of your colleagues along. They may or may not want to go, kind of thing. But if it's a great experience, you're probably a great advocate for it. So bring them along. Get your manager to come. Start to involve your company more in it, going back to your company and finding what do they have to offer this nonprofit. They might have skills. They might have a network. They might have resources. And start to drag them in, whether they know it or not, and covertly connect the two.
Yeah.
Then have the nonprofit thank the company. Someone at some level is going to kick that up, and you're going to get like a plaque or an award, and you're going to think.
And then you have an upward spiral.
Exactly.
Right? So it sounds like it's the two sides. I mean, for sure, there needs to be leadership of the organization involved, but I think leadership wants to see that the staff are interested.
Yeah.
So you can start at the grassroots level, get involved, and then leadership sees, gee, like 10 of my employees seem to be really keen on this issue.
Yeah.
We ought to get behind it.
That's how most of them start anyways. So either you've got someone at the highest level who loves volunteering and does a top-down approach, or you've got this groundswell and somebody notices and says, maybe we could capitalize on this and do something. So you got your push and your pull happening at the same time. But it won't get formalized as we are doing this as a company until you get one of those folks from that boardroom saying, this is good.
Great, great advice. Chris, I just got a couple of minutes for this first interview, and then, you know, listeners may be quite interested, so we'll open the phone lines up later in the show. Let me ask you just two final questions before we take a break. You know, you've stepped away from formal work world. You used to work in churches, and now you're kind of doing this thing on your own. Listeners are always curious about the money. You know, here you are. You've kind of created a very unique niche for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
How's the money?
There's no money in it for the first year and a half. None. We're just turning a corner in that actually now. We actually spent the first year creating content, blogging, researching, and then creating a network. And social media, we built the company on social media. That would be a great, actually, show to do maybe sometime. But social media was the foundation of this. So we built what we called an economic engine so we could realize this. And the economic engine was a cleaning company. Even in the economic downturn, a cleaning company is impervious.
You have a cleaning company that fuels the – what's the cleaning company called?
It's called Angie's Cleaning.
Yes.
And we're just actually selling it now. We've had it for 2 years. It's paid all the bills, met all our obligations, gave us enough time to do this. I phased out of that, moved over to this. But that's what we had to be willing to do. I had to be willing to clean toilets to get – to where I want to be.
I'm so glad I asked that question. Thanks for sharing that. Like, that's really important. Listeners need to know that. If you have some fragile idea that you want to take on and might not realize its income potential for a while, come up with a plan to help you do that.
Yes.
Angie's Cleaning. Okay, last question, Chris, for now. What have you learned now from your own personal experience about making career and life choices?
Oh, my gosh.
In 30 seconds or less.
That's like saying, what's the meaning of the universe? I've learned that what you don't know is probably never as important as what you have a hunch about. And ultimately, that's a weird way of saying you know more than you think. And just, I guess if you don't try it, you never know. It's like, it's so trite to say this, but Edison's 999 bad ideas for a light bulb got him to where he needed to go, right? And everybody I talk to who's doing something like this, there's no other way to get there than to bump around, grind, make it. I mean, just 3 days ago, I was looking at the ceiling going, oh, this is never going to work. This is it. Just don't believe that. Express it, but don't let those moments become your whole life.
Great. Thanks for that. And if listeners want to find out more, they want to check your blog, how do they do that?
Realizedworth.com.
Realized with a D. Realizedworth.com. Chris Jarvis, thanks for telling us your story here. It's been very inspirational, very interesting. Listeners, if you want to call in, we'll save a few minutes at the end of the show. You brought a piece of music for us. Do you want to just introduce it?
I run, and this is such a great song to run to in the morning when the sun's coming up. It's from WALL-E. It's I think it won an Academy Award. I can't remember the
theme
guy.
Theme song from WALL-E.
Theme song from WALL-E. It's great.
Coming down to the ground. There's no better place to go. We got snow. the fish in the ocean.
CIUT can now be heard on channel 946 through Rogers Digital Cable.
Like what you're hearing and want more of it? Check out our schedule at CIUT.fm. We have over 80 unique programs we're sure you'll love. We're listener supported. CIUT 89.5 FM.
We're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on to our next interview, I want listeners to know about the upcoming Enriching Lives and Careers trip to Nicaragua, put on by Career Cycles and Compañeros. It's coming up Feb 27 to March 7. It's a unique mix of community service, inspiring meetings with community leaders, homestays, excursions, and conversations about the experience and how it'll make a difference to your life back home. For info, check careercycles.com and click on the Nicaragua experience. And it actually ties in with our conversation about community service and volunteering that we had with Chris Jarvis, who was our last guest. If you're looking for that website and blog, check out realizedworth.com. Now, our next guest, Dean Dwyer, the way he says it is he began to quit shit and discovered that his life has taken an amazing turn for the better as a result. At the end of 2008, he quit his job because he realized he didn't like anything about it. He says it was like jumping out of an airplane not knowing if the thing on my back was a parachute, a backpack, or a chimpanzee. What happened? Life began to unfold as it should. Ideas started to come his way, and he began attracting more of what he wanted. What would he do, though, with himself? And indeed, what is he doing with himself? Dean says his goal is to create a movement of people like you to quit shit. Now, we're going to talk to Dean Dwyer, head quit honcho and quit bit blogger, and he joins us live in studio. Welcome to Career Buzz.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be here.
So, Dean, what do you like about your career these days?
First of all, I would like to thank you for that intro. After listening to Chris, my story doesn't sound quite so elegant. But, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question, Mark?
Yeah. So, what are you liking about the things that you're doing now?
Well, there's a lot of similarities to Chris's story about the whole idea of actually living life on my own terms. And I had very similar to what Chris was talking about. I had my epiphany December 14th of 2008 when I woke up in bed. I was a little bit past 40. I was 43, lying in bed thinking about the fact that I just wasn't doing what I really wanted to do. And I realized I was 25 years out of university, 25 years out of high school, and time had just flown by. And I realized that I could easily, another 25 years could come by, I'd be 68. And I'd still be wondering, what if I had taken a chance to do this? What if I'd taken a chance to do that? And ultimately just up and left my job and have since embarked on a whole journey of just trying to do things my own way.
Yes. And so doing things your own way, what are you doing these days?
So maybe, and I'll give you a little bit of backstory. So I was working, my background's teaching, and I taught for about 17 years. Loved teaching, but I didn't like the system. The system frustrated me, and I felt that I would have a greater opportunity affecting it from outside the system rather than from within. So I got involved with a digital media company, which I worked for a year and a half. Unfortunately, that, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners can relate to that, to this fact that I just in no way was I value connected with them at all in terms of where they were going, what they were doing, how they treated people, those sorts of things. And I realized that, again, that I had to get out. So I left. So I basically up and left. My first official day of unemployment was January 1st, 2009, which was probably the height of sort of our economic depression.
Right. Everything was going in the wrong direction at that time.
Yeah, it was. And it was really difficult to explain to people what I was doing because people didn't understand. Like, even close friends didn't understand. And I even got to the point where I had to tell people that I actually wasn't going to talk about the story because they just didn't get what I was doing. So there, and I found that I spent a lot of my time trying to justify my decision. So So I started blogging. I had initially launched a different blog. Yes. It was called the Dwyer Chronicles, and it was just basically my journey to find myself. Did that for about a month, realized that that was not going to pay the bills because I had no job at this point. So I had started to seek out people who were just doing interesting things. I had a few friends who had started their own businesses. And so I just thought, I'm just going to go out and start talking to people who are living life on their own terms the way I think that life should be lived, who also were very value-driven.
Yes.
And through that journey, I happened to meet up with a friend who they had a rent-to-own business, and they were doing some email marketing. And it wasn't being done the way they wanted it to be done. And I left that meeting, and I realized that's what my background, the previous job that I had, that was my background. I realized, you know, I can offer this as a service to people. So that's ultimately what I did. I started a consulting company where I actually provide, much like Chris was talking about with the cleaning business, I have greater aspirations of where I want to go with QuitBit. However, I have to pay the bills. And I think, unfortunately, there's this misconception out there, I think, about how success is created and how
Yes.
people go about creating these jobs that they love. You know, you hear too many of the stories about, you know, going from zero to $1 million in, you know, in 8 weeks, and this is how you can do it too. I don't think for most people that's how it occurs. So you do have to find something to supplement the income. And
so just to clarify what that is, what is that
sure.
something? Like it was –
So. My something right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, there's something on the side that's kind of fueling what you really want to do.
Right. So I provide for a few small businesses in Toronto, but I have one main client that I work for where I do the consulting for their email marketing.
Yeah.
So I but with that, I set my own hours. I work, geography. I'm not limited to geography. So which was, you know, one of the things when I decided to leave my job was I had made a list of all the things that I wanted. I wanted to be able to have the choice of working with really value-driven people. Especially I struggled with this when I was teaching because I worked with there were a lot of great teachers, but there were also a lot of people that I had to work with that didn't have the best interests of kids at heart. And I struggled with that because I had no control over that. I also wanted to be able to take advantage of opportunities to travel and still do my work, but, you know, get out to see my brother in Vancouver, or I got a chance to go to New York last week.
Right. So this consulting gig gives you that flexibility. You earn some money from it. And interestingly enough, similar to Chris's story, and I think lots of listeners, there's a metaphor out there called a kaleidoscope career. You know, imagine a kaleidoscope and you shift it and the grains shift around. So you have at least two things going. You have the QuitBit blog. You also have this consulting gig. And as time progresses, they shift around. Right, it's kind of a bit of a kaleidoscope.
Absolutely, and I think very similar to I think Chris's vision. Now, I launched QuitBit about 3 months ago, but I have a vision similar to Chris's in the sense that down the road, that will be my primary business in
yes.
terms of. And it gets me back. It's funny, when I taught, I always struggled with the fact that I thought I should be doing something else. And once I left, I realized that at heart, I am a teacher, and I have always loved the aspect of teaching. And QuitBit gets me the opportunity to kind of get back to that and to do the things
that
I really love.
Yeah, you had to leave to realize what it was that you liked about what you didn't like. So talking about teaching, you know, we like in the show to follow the trajectory of people's careers, the arc, just to see how all those different pieces come together. Now, how did you end up choosing teaching back when?
I am probably the worst guy to tell a career story in terms of how my career evolved. But I literally, in high school, you have to make your decision about where you want to go. And I went into my guidance counselor. I had no idea what I wanted to do.
Yes.
And he said, oh, you're really good at maths and sciences. Why don't you do that? And I looked at him and I said, okay. So he decided what I was going to do. Did that for the first year. Hated it. I wasn't passionate about it at all. So I ended up switching to physical and health education. And sure enough, at the end of my 4 years of university, I had to decide what I was going to do with that degree. And I really had two options, either work in the health and fitness industry, which I wasn't interested in, or teach. And I thought, well, let's try teaching. I was fortunate enough to get into teacher's college at that particular time.
But you just picked among a universe of two choices. Like, there are 30,000 careers listed in the National Occupational Classification of this country, and you narrowed it down to two, but not narrowed it down. You looked at it as if there were only two.
As I said, I'm definitely not giving career advice to people.
No, but what you are doing is you're illustrating something for listeners who will definitely relate to it, and all the people that I've spoken to in career counseling, you hear that so often. You know, and even before that, your guidance counselor says, and it doesn't sound like it was a very useful awful thing to say. Gee, Dean, you're good at math and science. Why don't you do that? That was it, like a whole career conversation in 5 minutes saying, look at your report card and you like this, so why don't you go and do it? Any thoughts on what kind of guidance counseling conversation should happen in high school?
Well, to be fair to my guidance counselor, he was a great guy.
He might be listening too.
He was a great guy. I can't put the blame on him. You know what? It was funny. When I started to teach, one of the things that if I had to do it again,
yes.
Mark, I actually would not, when I finished high school, I would not have gone to university right away. And I contemplated this at that time, but I was thinking, I thought, well, maybe I can go to the Army, maybe I can travel. But not many people were doing it at that time, and my worry was, well, if I don't go to university now, I never will. But in looking back on it, I would definitely get involved in experiential type things. Much of some of the things that Chris was just talking about earlier.
Like a gap year. The term now is out there, gap year.
Yeah.
It started in the UK. In Canada, we're using it a lot more. And typically it means, in the UK, the gap year after high school before post-secondary. In Canada, it's a little more flexible of a term, and people are doing that during post-secondary or after post-secondary, and often doing things like volunteering, you know, community service things.
Exactly. It's virtually, you know, it's impossible to ask a 17-year-old kid mm-hmm. to figure out what they're going to commit their, you know, their next 4 years to that they're supposed to work for mm-hmm. theoretically for the rest of their life. I mean, you haven't done anything. How could you possibly know what you want to do?
Well, there's the flawed model. You know, the education often isn't directed towards a career. Mm-hmm. You do, especially university education. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity to learn about yourself and what you're interested in.
Absolutely.
And except parents say, well, what are you going to do with that degree mm-hmm. in philosophy? Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a judgment in those questions. And people feel that. I think if you're young, if you're listening to this show and you are finishing high school or early in your post-secondary education, that's a really important time. And we forget later how urgent the feeling is to get going on your career. And that you must have felt that urgency. I can't go and take a year off. I got to go right into post-secondary.
Well, there's a societal pressure that comes with that. I mean, as I said, even when I up and left my job last year, people were looking at me going, what are you, insane? Like, you know, and they mean well, but
yes.
But most people are responding from their own fears.
Yes.
So, you know, they don't understand your decision because it's not something that they would do.
Yeah.
Consequently, you know, they if you listen to them, they'll end up talking you out of what you want to do. And I wasn't smart enough. Smart's probably not the right word, but I didn't have the wherewithal in grade 13 to be able to say, you know what?
Yes.
I don't think university is the thing that I want to do right now. I'm going to go out and venture out and just discover the world. And again, you know what? In hindsight, I wish that's what I had done, but I don't have any regrets over that because
we
all.
What's done is done. Like James Hillman said, looking at past events, the best thing to say is it couldn't have happened any other way.
Exactly.
Because you know what? If it happened in some other way, there'd be some other universe and we'd be talking to a different dean and we'd be on some other planet.
And who knows what that dean would be like.
So there's two quitting stories here. Let me fast forward to 17 years as a teacher. That's a very stable career. If there are any teachers here, and I know I've spoken to lots of teachers, they sometimes think about leaving, but they don't because they have really good pension, you know, and they can get to pension early. And if you invested so much time in it, people feel like they kind of have those handcuffs. How did you step away from that after 17 years?
I think it was a little easier for me. And it might just be a genetic thing. A lot of people, it's funny, you know, when you talk about risk, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, I'm a risk taker. I think risk is relative to everyone, where there are some areas in my life that, that it looks like I'm taking risk. I don't see it that way. So for example, with the career choice to leave teaching, for me, the bigger question was, this is not where I see. I don't want to be that guy or that girl who. Well, I guess I can't be a girl. That's a bad analogy. I don't want to be that guy who, you know, at 65 has stuck around in a job because it was secure.
Exactly what Chris was saying.
Exactly
the same perspective, right? And that's maybe a useful question for listeners to be asking themselves. You know, think about that. Do I want to invest all this amount of time in what I'm doing, or do I have something else that I really want to try? And do I want to get to that point and say I didn't try?
And I didn't need to be. I don't need to be 70 to look back and say I know I would be disappointed. I could see that now, and I thought if I don't make that decision, I'm definitely going to regret it.
Yes, Chris, you had a thought on that?
Yeah, the way it worked out for me is I just projected 10 years down the road. And I said at 50, what kind of choices do I want to be able to have that I wouldn't have if I just stay on this track? And I could identify those.
Yeah.
I could clearly identify those.
And I had that same thing last year when I decided, like, what do I want out of my work? And literally within about 72, it was about 48 hours, I made the decision to leave my job. You know, once I had identified, okay, what do I want? And decided I was tired of not having any influence over those. It was an easy decision.
We're talking to Dean Dwyer and Chris Jarvis here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. Guys, we do have about 10 minutes more. Dean, I want to hear more of your story, but I also want to invite listeners, if they have comments or questions for either of our guests, to give us a call. The phone number here is 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. So, Dean, you quit the job as a teacher, and then you ended up in a digital media company.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Quite by accident, actually. I started going to a Starbucks in my area from about 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., and as a matter of fact, that's where I met Chris. I meet a lot of people, a lot of interesting people at Starbucks.
There's a plug for Starbucks.
And I used to go there from 6 to 8 to just try to work on, you know, figuring out what I wanted to do, and happened to just be sitting in a group of people who I got to know, and one of these guys happened to have a business. And I have always loved writing. I just never considered myself to be a writer. That's a whole other story as well, in terms of what you think you're good at and what you don't think you're good at. But I had always loved writing. He wanted some writing done for some of the work that he was doing, and I said I would do it. And from that, I actually made an offer to work for him. I saw an opportunity there. As a matter of fact, I guess I've done that now. The last two gigs that I've had is that I have seen opportunities in other businesses, and that's how I started my consulting business.
Great. So no job posting. You just saw an opportunity through your talking to people in networking, and you're at Starbucks, great place to meet people, and this happens. And you realized one of your strengths, and you enjoy using it, is writing. So you knew that, and this guy has some opportunity for you to use your writing in some way that's going to make money for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So that worked out perfectly.
It did.
But then you got a job, and then you didn't like it. What didn't you like about that job that led you to quit?
Well, you know, and I think a lot of people will probably relate to this as well. But there was, you know, it's like a new relationship. Everything starts off, the honeymoon is fantastic, everything is great, and then after a few months, you know, once you've settled in, you start to notice little things. For me, it was just it basically came down to we had a completely different value system. You know, I think on paper, oftentimes when things go awry, there's two ways to handle things. There's the way they should be done, but then this is what we're actually going to do. There are very few people that do what should be done. You know, usually they make decisions because, you know, well, we can't do that because it's going to cost us money, those sorts of things. And I found that a lot of the decisions that were being made were not to the benefit of our clients. You know, it was, you know, we were selling them stuff they didn't need. We were telling them to do things that they didn't have to do. So, I really, really struggled with that. So I just
integrity.
Decided,
it was missing integrity.
And, you know, it that eats you up after, you know, you almost feel you're selling your soul. And I just made that decision that I thought, you know what, I can't, this is not, it wasn't long before I saw the writing was on the wall. And it was another one where, and you learn from experience as well. I had stayed in teaching, I think, far longer than I should have stayed. Because I realized that, again, I didn't fit there. And I saw rather quickly that I didn't fit here either. So I it was one of those things. I thought, I don't have to go through this process again and drag it on.
So you learned. That's good. You learned. You didn't let that one last 17 years this time.
Thankfully. I only have so many years to play with. I can't keep doing these 17-year cycles. And so I just, again, I made the decision to up and leave. But I, you know, as I said, most people were uncomfortable with the decision, but it's been the best thing I've ever done.
Good. Well, you're saying it with a big smile on your face, and you seem really relaxed as you're talking about it, you know, so other people may be stressed, and that's their projection onto you, but you seem really relaxed about the choices that you've made, even though it's less secure, and I think that's what people worry about, is the security issue.
It's not easy. Chris mentioned it earlier. You know, you have moments where you think, what the heck am I doing? You know, and it is easy to get overwhelmed with negativity. Like, I had somebody ask me, you know, like, what would be the biggest advice, you know, you would give somebody who was going to do something like this. I made a few decisions. I had stopped. I stopped reading the papers. I had stopped listening to the news, and I was really selective who I told my story to, because if you tell the wrong person, they're going to find fault and they're going to poke holes in it. And these are good friends. They're family members. They're not. We're not just talking about, you know, Joe
Yes.
Schmo on the street. You really have to know who you can tell your story to and who you can't, because some people are just not capable of seeing the opportunity that exists. And if you're not careful, you're going to buy into their story, and you're going to start to realize that, you know what, this can't happen, and they're right, I can't do this. And you're going to fall back on, you know, I'll stay in my job, I won't leave.
Yes, so be careful who you're sharing your story with.
I was really careful. My best story was my friend had invited us up to a cottage, and I said, you know what, I said, I'm going to come, but I said, I'm telling you right now, I'm not answering any questions about my career. He's like, what? I said, I'm not answering any questions about my career, because I said, I know people up there are not going to understand. I said, I'm not going to spend a week, you know, I didn't want to spend all my energy justifying what I was doing. I thought that's not going to lead me to, you know, the opportunities that do exist.
So we just have a few minutes. Let's talk a bit about the blog. It's called QuitBit.
QuitBit.
Right? QuitBit.com, is that where it is?
QuitBit.com.
Now, I love this idea that you're starting at number 1,000 and you're working your way backwards. Like, that's really interesting. So it builds in quitting into the blogging experience itself.
I never looked at it that way.
When you're done, you're done.
You're done. So how do you feel about it? Like, it's going to actually end in, I don't know, you know, a couple of hundred days or something.
You know what? What I liked about it, I actually saw the idea of 1,000 on another blog, and I started thinking about it, and I thought what I liked about it was it actually gave me an end date. One of the things I struggled with was teaching was that there's no clear end point. You don't know what kind of impact you have. But I thought with the blog, 1,000 is daunting, because I thought, how am I going to come up with 1,000 ideas? But I thought, you know, I don't have to come up with 1,000. I just need to come up with one. So, for example, I had a blog post today. So I need to come up with one for today. I need to come up with one for Sunday. Then I'll need to come up with one for Monday. And I'm just going to take it one at a time. But to me, 1,000 sounds daunting, and I thought it's a great target to shoot for.
Number 990, quit thinking big. Why there's magic in thinking small. And you write, the problem with thinking big is that many of us get lost in the vastness of big. It is so large, so daunting, so immense that we don't know where to begin. I thought that was really interesting, and I wonder, just in the last few minutes that we have, is to talk about that thought, that there are big things out there. People think of big thoughts of what they should do with their career and life, and it's daunting because it's so big, or a corporate volunteer program, and how do I move this ship? I'm just one person. What can listeners do to quit thinking too big? Dean?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. It's also a difficult question to answer. I guess for each person, it depends who they are, right? It said my personality. In some ways, I did go big in the sense of, you know, just quitting my job. But that's not what I would recommend for everybody. I wouldn't go out and say, listen, go out and quit your job and start doing this. But there are small things you can do. I think even if we go back to Chris's example about. You know, if you are looking at, because for example, I've had this conversation numerous times. Most people don't know what they want to do. Like, you know, they want to do something else, but they don't know what, and they just sit there. Well, you know, you could take Chris's idea with volunteerism, and why not just go out and start, you know, volunteering some of your time somewhere else, just to see what else you might be interested in. And we all have an idea anyway, what we really would like to do. The problem is we sit at home and we just magically wait for it to fall.
Yeah, so dip your toe in the water. You don't have to jump in, right? Is the thing. Chris, any quick comment on that about, you know, related to corporate volunteering? How can you start small, something that's totally doable?
In again, 12 steps we say just for today, right? So I don't have to get clean and sober for the rest of my life. I just have to do it for today.
Yes.
And that builds on what you were saying, Dean, about I couldn't come up with 1,000, but I could come up with one idea today. I can do it today. And if you're committed to that one thing for that one day, I think eventually you can eat the elephant.
Great. Last question to you that I asked to Chris. Dean, what have you learned about making career and life choices?
I probably the greatest thing for me was just to act on the thing that scares me the most. You know, this idea of quitting my job and having no net to fall, you know, with no safety net, quite frankly scared the crap out of me. And willingness to just to take the chance to
Your
do that.
Fear is a clue. Your fear is interesting. It's a clue. It's related to the hunches that you were talking
about.
Yeah,
definitely.
Right? You brought a piece of music in. We're just going to play it on the outro. What is that piece of music?
It's a song called I'm Yours by Jason Mraz. And I just love the it's just got a great beat to it.
Dean Dwyer, Chris Jarvis, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
That was awesome to be here.
You've been listening to Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM, the show that's all about empowering lives, enriching careers, and energizing organizations. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. You can find out more about me at careercycles.com. The other two hosts of Career Buzz are Leanne Sachs at Living in the Moment and Louisa Jewell at whydidyougo.com. If you have any comments on today's show, please email me. It's mark@careercycles.com. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to Eric teching today's show. An MP3 of this show will be available on the Career Buzz link at www.careercycles.com. That's it for today's live